Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd, tucked away in my little home office. As we enter the second week of social isolation, one thing is becoming apparent. More and more people are using their time away from work and school to get outdoors. If there's one silver lining to this pandemic, it may be that people are reconnecting with nature. Today, we discuss the value of nature in our lives, why many of us are losing connections with the natural world, and what it means for our health and the health of our ecosystem. Joining us is Richard Louv. He's the author of numerous books, including Last Child in the Woods. His latest book is Our Wild Calling, How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs. Good morning.
Good morning, Missy.
So many of us think back to our childhoods when we were outside playing without grown-ups and without structure. Children don't play outside the same way today. When did this type of outside, unstructured play begin to wane in our country, and what are some of the reasons why?
Well, probably about three decades ago that separation really began. You can argue that it began long before that with the invention of agriculture, industrialized cities, and all of that. But in our lifetime, or at least in mine, the last few decades have seen a rapid decrease in the amount of time that kids spend outside. There are a lot of reasons for that. One of them, obviously, is electronics. Now we're realizing that electronics may help us get outside, at least in a virtual way, during the current situation. But we blame it too much, I think, on electronics. It's also just fear of strangers. Parents are just terrified of, you know, who might be at the corner. When in actuality, the rate of violent crime against children outside the house, at least, has been going down. With the exception of school shootings, it's been going down for several decades. Bad urban design, we get preached at to go for a walk. Walk where in many of the neighborhoods? Yeah. So there are a lot of reasons for this, but it has immense implications for our psychological health, our physical health, and our social health, which is ironic right now.
Yeah. In your current book, you talk about an epidemic of loneliness. And while you say epidemic may be an exaggeration, you quote former U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, who wrote, "We live in the most technologically connected age in the history of civilization, yet rates of loneliness have doubled since the 1980s.
And that's true. And it is called by some medical folks an epidemic. And currently, and this precedes the current social isolation that people are experiencing. Loneliness is now thought by the medical community to be on par with smoking and obesity as a cause of early death, because of suicide, but because of all of the diseases that are associated with human isolation. That's often blamed on Facebook and anti-social media, and there's a lot of blame to go around. But in Our Wild Calling, the new book about our relationship with other animals, I suggest that this loneliness is rooted in an even deeper loneliness, which is species loneliness. You know, the urban parks that have the best psychological benefit for human beings happen to be the ones with the highest biodiversity. I don't think that's an accident. I think that we as a species are desperate not to feel alone in the universe. And obviously that has religious implications, but in truth, as I argue in this book, we're not alone. We're surrounded by an ongoing conversation of a larger family of animals and to an extent of plants, if we pay attention.
Yeah. In the book, you describe individuals who make a habit of sitting quietly in the outdoors, even in their own backyard or on their front stoop, and just observing. What happens to them and the animals around them when they do this?
Well, John Young, who's one of the world's preeminent nature educators, he doesn't like to be called an educator, he talks about creating a sit spot. And this is one of the things that we can do when we're in this physical isolation now with the current situation. It can be in your backyard. It can be at the edge of the yard. It doesn't have to be in a national park. You just pick a spot, whether you're a kid or an adult, and sit there and wait for the life to come back. By that, I mean, as a kid, I used to go down to a creek And I would sit down after all the frogs had disappeared, jumped into the water. And I would sit next to the water, and I would wait patiently, and pretty soon I'd see the noses of the frogs start to pop up at the water's surface. And I would sit there, and I would kind of listen and watch, and pretty soon they were responding as if I wasn't there. And then I heard birds I hadn't heard, and then I saw insects I hadn't noticed. I noticed the pattern on the water. I noticed the way the wind was. That's the kind of thing that can happen even in a backyard. It doesn't happen, or even a, you know, sitting next to a window and looking out the window at nature. If you can't go out, it really brings the senses alive. And, you know, it doesn't have a direct impact. It has an indirect impact on the nature around us, but it's a quietness. It's an ability to communicate at a deeper level, I think.
Yeah, I think gardeners can relate. It's almost kind of a meditative thing. You know, as you said, when you first walk out there, everything kind of scatters. But then when you're there for a few minutes, they sort of, it's like, okay, we can come back now. Like you say, the birds and the different bees and whatnot. Now, some people describe these moments of connection with animals as spiritual or magical. What do you think is happening in those moments? And do you get the sense animals are also experiencing something out of the ordinary?
Well, let me answer that with a brief story. The new book, Our Wild Calling, is filled with stories that people have sent me or told me about their extraordinary encounters with either wild animals or their ongoing relationships with companion animals. With wild animals, this can happen. This can just last for a few seconds, but it's very meaningful to the people when they tell these stories. And this is a common denominator of these stories. And I'll tell you a story that is my story. It's a very quick one. I was on a lake one day in the early morning in my boat. My boat has an electric motor. I noticed on the shore two giant birds that I thought were turkey buzzards. And I wanted to look at them closer because they were eating something. So I eased up, got within 20 feet of them very quietly. And they were not vultures. There were two giant golden eagles. And for what seemed like forever, they would reach down and take a bite of the carp and then look up at me. Their eyes never left my eyes, over and over. And it seemed like it lasted forever. This is one of the common denominators of these stories. People's sense of time goes away or bends. It's almost an altered state. Now, I cannot speak for the eagles. They may have just been trying to decide if I was edible. But what I felt was something between us that changed, that shifted. I went home and I was telling my son about that. He was home from college. And I said, I don't know what happened right then. It was very strange. And said, Matthew, whoever I say I am, I'm not. Whoever I really am is who I was in those moments with the eagles. And I don't have the human words to describe that. Yeah. So many of the stories that people told me were exactly that, were exactly that sense. And I have a name for that that is between us, and I call it the habitat of the heart. That's what I felt. And again, I'm not talking for the animals. They may feel it too. I don't know. But yeah. This is a very intense feeling that people often report.
Yeah, and you have there's some great stories in the book. And I think it kind of has you reflect on your own moments. I was just thinking, you know, your story with the eagles. Last summer, I was in my backyard and this beautiful red-tailed hawk just flew up into a tree. And I watched it and I got pretty, you know, close to the tree. Not that I could reach up as far as that hawk was, but it was keeping an eye on me as much as I was keeping an eye on it. And it was just amazing how all of a sudden it was up there for maybe 20 minutes and then it swooped down into my garden and grabbed a rat and, you know, hopped out, stayed a few seconds and then flew off with it. But I was amazed at its ability to see through all of that greenery and get that rat, but also while it's doing its sort of visual hunting, also keeping an eye on me.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
And it's wonderful that you have a story. You know, almost everybody I run into has a story that has something about that experience sticks. Something about it moves us.
Yeah. And we'd love to hear your stories. If you have a story that you'd like to share with us, 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. You can also shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. You talk about a challenge to human exceptionalism. You write, "We humans are not the only story. Intelligent life populated Earth long before we came on the scene. Now we know that humans and whales share specialized neurons associated with higher cognitive functions, including self-awareness and compassion, and that these neurons may have developed in parallel. These neurons developed in whales 30 million years before our own." That's fascinating.
Well, I think so, too.
Yeah, I did not know that.
That. I didn't discover that, obviously. I'm reporting other research. But, yeah, we're not alone on this Earth. And you mentioned loneliness before, and the species loneliness. Again, we're not alone. There is this vast conversation around us. And the more that science learns about animal communication and, to an extent, plant communication, the less impressive human language becomes. I mean, it's still impressive, but it's not the only way to communicate. Even one-celled bacteria can talk in a way. They use quorum sensing, which is the passage of signaling molecules from individual cell to individual cell. The way that other animals and plants and life communicates with each other is extraordinary, and we're learning more and more about that.
Yeah, and the intelligence that animals have that we perhaps, you know, didn't understand. I have another quick story. I lived in Vermont on a river, and I had a German shepherd who used to swim in the river for exercise. I used to throw things out, and there was a beaver den close by. And the beavers, he thought he could catch those beavers in the water, which was never going to happen. But they were so smart. A beaver would, you know, flap its tail like, "Hey, I'm over here," to keep him away from the den. And then I would watch, another beaver would kind of come out and take that one's place. So they would, you know, tire out the dog, but not tire out themselves. And I thought, well, how smart are they?
Yeah. Well, there's a professor at Northern Arizona University, last name I cannot pronounce, but he's been doing a lot of research on the language of prairie dogs. And he's been recording the language and decoding it using digital technology. And he says that prairie dog communication, of all of the animals he has studied, is the most sophisticated animal language that he's decoded, with the exception of human language. And he, for instance, he says that the prairie dog at the edge of the colony can see someone or something coming and report it in quite some detail. If it's a person, they can say the person is wearing a white shirt and dark pants. They may not say shirt or pants, but they describe that person in some detail, and then they report it. And it turns out they're very good journalists. They don't do fake news, and the word passes from prairie dog to prairie dog until the whole prairie dog town knows it. He's recording that, decoding it. He believes, this professor, that at some point he'll be able to run this language, their language, into a computer and understand what they're saying in English or in some other human language, and that we may be able to talk into a computer, and this turns our language into prairie dog language. There's a lot of new understanding of
it's fascinating. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Richard Louv. His new book is Our Wild Calling, How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs. 866-999-4626 is our number. How are you and your family enjoying nature or the outdoors during this time of social isolation? Have you had any unexpected moments during these experiences? We hope you'll share your story. 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. You note some really interesting experiences in the book, and I'm going to sprinkle some through this interview if you don't mind, but I'd love you to tell the story about the urchin.
The diver and the urchin. A young woman who lives in South America sent me this story, and she talked about scuba diving or snorkeling one day. And she was down in the rocks, and she looked at this little animal, this urchin that looks, it's hard to describe, but an urchin does not look like an animal. It looks more like a plant. And it was acting in this very interesting way, and she got up very close to it and was looking at it. It was so beautiful. And she reached out and touched it, and it did not respond in an aggravated way. And she was just watching it, and she was just enthralled with this urchin. And the experience really touched her. And then later she found out that this urchin is poisonous, and really poisonous, this particular species. She never felt threatened by it. She doesn't advise us to go and commune with urchins. But she felt that feeling I was describing before, this connection with other life. And she's never forgotten that urchin.
Mm. Yeah. Let's talk to Meg, who's giving us a call from Harwich. Hi, Meg.
Hi. Well, I don't put out a bird feeder very often, but in this time I put out a bird feeder, got better seed besides my black oil sunflower seed, and it's been very nice. And one of the lovely things, besides watching the creatures outside, I looked at my bookcase and I found great cattails. And I have a cat in the house, and the cat is a wonderful companion. I'm not one of those crazy people that dresses up their cat, though. But anyway, it's very nice to see it outside, even if you're not doing the walking, to see the birds. And it's interesting, but the cat books, I think it's a nice time to order some books, because you don't have to go out for that. Order the books, they're delivered, and it's fun. And I did every one with their animal books, and I say, do it. You'll enjoy it.
All right. Meg, thanks for sharing. Thanks for calling. Bird feeders are for a lot of people, that they can be, if you can't get out especially, you can put it near a window that you can watch all the birds. And it's amazing, too, when a hawk comes along, how they can almost become invisible. They just sort of, up against that bark of the tree, or they just are so still, you don't even see them. Bill is giving us a call from Orleans. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Mindy. How are you?
I'm good.
Oh, that's good. I'm in my wood shop over in Orleans, as you said. I'm a commercial fisherman. I've gone to sea for the last 45 years on trawlers, longliners, handliners. I have an experience that I thought I would share. It's a fantastic topic, and I've been waiting a long time to tell this story, and this seemed like the appropriate time. So we're fishing out of Chatham at the time. We're trawling out on a piece of bottom we call the Mussels, southeast of Chatham. We've seen thousands of whales, spending so many hours and days at sea, mostly humpback whales. They're the most gregarious, tend to be rather friendly, and don't have a problem with approaching the vessels. So we're towing along at about 3 knots, and there was a group, a large pod, not too far away, and I was out on deck looking out at the whales, and all of a sudden, a large male, I believe it was, came up alongside the boat. And I've seen them fairly close over the years, but this one came alongside the boat, and I looked down at its head. It was quite close to the surface, and I made contact with its eye. I'd never seen the eye of a whale up close like that, and the amazing thing was it moved in its socket, something that I never even gave a thought to. It glanced forward towards the bow, it glanced back at the stern, and then it focused directly on me. And it swam alongside for about 10 seconds, literally checking me out. At least that's the feeling I had from it. He saw me. Visual contact, without a doubt.
Yeah. Wow.
Continued
what a magical
along for
moment.
Second or two. Yeah, it was pretty amazing. And then it sounded, as they always do, off it went and rejoined its herd. And that was the last of it. But an experience that I've carried all these years is pretty amazing.
Yeah, wow. What a magical moment. Thanks so much, Bill, for sharing that. These are the kind of stories, Richard, that you get all the time, I bet.
Yeah, and that's a wonderful story in the way he told it, too. First, what was notable is he said he'd waited a long time to tell that story. Yeah. People are a little embarrassed sometimes, and some of the stories in the book, I'm the first person they told that story to. You know, they worry about being accused of being too new agey and things like that. But again and again, people tell this kind of story. In fact, there's a couple stories. There's one in the book about a very similar encounter of a whole family with a whale that came up and looked at them like that. And your caller said a wonderful sentence. He said, I think he said, the whale saw me. And that was what struck him. He had been seen, really seen by another living creature that he didn't expect. The family that had a similar encounter. Now, this is a guy in business. He's made a lot of money. He's a hardcore businessman. He's not given to saying this kind of thing. But he said when that whale came up and looked at them and saw them, his whole family burst into tears.
Yeah. It's amazing. Bill, thanks again for sharing that story with us. Janet is calling from West Tisbury. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning. As you know, I have a horse and a cat and a wild cat that I'm feeding. And I have lots of birds, which I feed. And I have 8 deer that come in my yard every night at 5:30. I have skunks and an occasional raccoon. And last night, the skunk chased the deer. I couldn't believe it. They're afraid of skunks. It made, you know how they stomp their feet and put their tail up? Well, the deer just took off. They were terrified.
And yeah, nobody wants to smell like a skunk.
I know. But, you know, I have a skunk that comes to the door, and I feed it a cat chow. It scratches at the door just like a cat would.
Wow.
And
it knows you're not a threat, right? That you've got food.
No, and I can go out. Yeah, pretty soon. There were 3 a couple nights ago. They're starting to have their children, I think, babies, you know. And they bring them over here, and they drink the bird water. And they finish up the, I feed on the ground because I've got a lot of ground feeding birds, and they will eat what the birds don't eat. And then they bring their babies.
Wow.
And some of them have as many as 8.
Is that right? Wow.
And I can go out amongst them and they won't hurt me.
That's amazing.
You know, if I walk slowly and talk to them, you know, they don't bother me.
Yeah.
But if a deer comes by,
get ready to run.
Yeah.
No, I trust them, and they know they have never been nasty to me at all. And if you know animals and know how to walk around them and not be threatening. But I have a regular routine with my animals, and it's kind of lonely because you can't really go out very much now, but I do keep contact with my friends on the telephone, the old-fashioned way. Okay. And but the animals, they've always been a big part of my life, ever since I was a kid.
Yeah.
Anyway, I thought I'd tell you that, and it's probably keeping me fairly sane. You know, you have a routine, you don't have to think about the horrors all the time.
Right, and you can see the magic of all of those animals in your yard. Janet, thank you for sharing. We really appreciate that. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you have a story to share, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Over the decades, we've been warned by many scientists and biologists not to attribute human emotions or behaviors to animals. So what are your thoughts on anthropomorphism and its value in helping us connect with animals?
Well, that's been a taboo that dates back to Descartes, who considered animals machines, and that we should not in any way see them as equals to human beings or anywhere close to equal. That's changing among some of the most important biologists. They no longer hold that to be quite so taboo. Yes, it's important not to overdo that. You know, if we attribute our characteristics too much to other animals, we'll start seeing them for what they are. It takes the whale away from the whale. On the other hand, Franz De Waal, who's a wonderful professor and writer who wrote Mama's Last Hug about primates, he breaks anthropomorphism into 3 categories. One is anthropocentrism. That's an assumption that you as a human being are at the center of the universe and all the other creatures are there for your use or entertainment. The second category is anthropodenial. In other words, you're in anthrodenial. You don't you have a blindness to the human-like characteristics of other animals, the characteristics we share with other life. And the third one is animal centrism. And that's an effort to use empathy, to understand and feel what life must be like for a member of another species. That's the kind of relationship with other animals that we can't throw that out with the bathwater when we are, you know, rejecting anthropomorphism. In that sense, anthropomorphism is highly underrated.
You note that, you know, bats and dogs and mice can hear sounds we cannot, and you point out to understand the mind of another animal, we need to learn as much as possible about their abilities and sensory worlds. We need to know what brain structures underlie their emotions. That's a really important point.
There's a scientist named Gordon Burkhardt who some years ago came up with a method he calls critical anthropomorphism. He is a psychologist, herpetologist, and he says in order to study a snake, as a scientist, in order to study a snake, you have to sit with the snake. You have to be with the snake. And he says critical anthropomorphism has two steps. The first step is, as you're watching that snake, being with that snake, you conjure up in your mind all of the hard science that you remember, that you know about how that snake is sensing the world. What's it doing with its tongue? All of that intellectually, you conjure that up. The second step, he said, is use your imagination to the best of your limited human ability. Imagine what it must be like to be that snake. What is it sensing? What is it seeing? What is it feeling? Now, that's an exercise that may not have a lot to do with what the snake is actually feeling or sensing, but it opens us up to that snake. It opens us up through empathy. And he says if you do those two things through critical anthropomorphism, you're far more likely to ask the right scientific questions. This is not anti-science. This is pro-science. I'd love to see critical anthropomorphism taught in middle school. You know, middle school was about the time that biology, for many of us as kids, the magic went out of biology. We may have been, you know, been fascinated with snakes. We may have known every animal that lived in the field behind our house. And then we get to middle school and they turn it all into math. Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with that. Biochemistry is important. But when you take the magic out of that, when you take the empathy out of that, it no longer becomes interesting to many students, and we need those students too.
Yeah. Let's talk to Dennis, who's giving us a call from Yarmouthport. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I think it's actually Denise, but hello.
Oh, Denise, morning. I'm sorry. Good morning,
okay,
Denise.
I've been called Dennis many times. I have a story from years ago. I was out at SeaWorld. And I don't know if you remember, but perhaps you do, there was a baby gray whale named JJ who was rescued out of the Pacific. And I don't know whatever happened to her, but I tried to follow her online, but I sort of just couldn't find any more articles. But long story short, she was a very small, she was a gray whale. And they rescued her. They brought her to SeaWorld, and she was already so large that they had to take their largest tank and put her in it, and they knew they could only keep her there for a short time. Anyway, I was visiting SeaWorld, and it was after the kids had all gone back to school in the fall. I was there on a weekday. It was very quiet, and we were able to watch JJ being fed. And they basically what they did was they her formula or chum or whatever you would like to call it, she required so much of it. They had a staff that was making it 24/7 just
wow.
to keep her fed. And they were caring for her and trying to get her to the point that she would be well enough to be released once she outgrew the tank. So long story short, what they would do is they would tap the water at the top of the tank to let her know it was feeding time. So we were able to stand at the side of the tank as she came up. And it was so quiet that day, we were probably less than 6 feet away from her. So, and she was already huge. I mean, she was a baby, but she was ginormous. anyway, they would tap the tank, and they had these big pails, metal pails of formula, and she would come up and they would feed her, and we were right there watching it. And I have told my friends over the years that it was the closest thing to a religious experience I've ever had. And I'm not a terribly religious person, but it was just amazing to be that close to that kind of creature. Yeah. And it was definitely something I'll never forget.
Yeah, it's amazing how those moments just live with you forever. Denise, thanks for sharing that. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Richard, will you tell the story of the octopus?
Sure. It's one of my favorite stories in the book. This is Paul Dayton is a well-known oceanographer. He's one of the most well-known oceanographers. And he is at Scripps Institution of Oceanography in San Diego. And he told me about when he was a student at the University of Washington. He was on the bottom of the ocean one day collecting samples for his classes, but also collecting lunch. He was a student. And he was in his scuba gear, and he was turning over starfish, looking for his samples. And suddenly he felt come above him. He just sensed this, something very large that stopped above him. That's usually not a good sign. And he turned really slowly his face, and he saw this long tentacle coming down, then looked to the right, and another long tentacle. And risking anthropomorphism, of course, as he told this story, he said it was one of those giant 12-foot leg span octopuses of the Pacific, and it thought I was a clam, and it came down and got me. And it wrapped him up in its arms, in its tentacles, and he says, people think those tentacles of an octopus are soft. They're anything but. You can't budge them. And he was trapped. He was held by that octopus. About then, realized he was almost out of air. And so with his last strength, he kicked off the bottom, and he and the octopus started going up in the water through a column of water toward the surface very slowly. And as they went up, the octopus, he felt moving around his body, and he could feel the razor-sharp beak of the octopus moving around his neck until he saw the eye of the octopus. And just as your earlier caller talked about that moving, striking moment when you truly look into the eye of another animal. And he said it was very moving, and he didn't know, and he was running out of air. And about that time, they broke the surface, both of them. He rips off his mask, and he's looking down through the water, and the octopus is still there, right underneath the surface, looking at him, never losing eye contact. And then the octopus turned, and as Paul says, turned into kind of a shape of a space shuttle, and then it disappeared down into the darkness. And what does Paul do next is the best part of the story. He puts his mask back on, and he chases the octopus down into as far as he could go. And as they went down, they spiraled each other until he ran out of breath, and he went to the surface again. I said, Paul, why in the world would you do such a thing? And he did not know why he did it. I guess it was a spiritual moment. This is a hardcore scientist, and he's not given to speaking like that. And all he knew is those moments were so important to him. He did not want that moment to end. And that's why he chased the octopus down.
Yeah.
That, again, is what people describe again and again with these extraordinary experiences.
I love Peter Godfrey Smith's description of an octopus. He says, meeting an octopus is like meeting an intelligent alien. So true.
And that's an important point. I'm not saying in the book anywhere that this intelligence is the same as ours. That, you know, there's a mystery here that I don't pretend to understand or know, and I don't think the storytellers in the book pretend to fully understand that. And that's what it makes it, in part, so important to them.
Yeah. We have an email from Pat who says, as I'm listening this morning, I heard a woman suggest that we send away for books and have them delivered. I just want to put in a local plug for Titcomb's Bookstore, who's offering curbside service. If you call and request a book, they'll take your credit card number and come to the parking lot with your purchase when you arrive. I'd love folks to know about this in order to support local business at this difficult time. So, yes, and check with your other local bookstores. There may be others doing the same thing. That's a great tip. Thank you, Pat, for that. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Richard Louvre. His new book is Our Wild Calling, How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to share an interaction you've had with an animal. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We have one more segment left, Richard, and I have like so many questions that are never going to get answered. But I want to, before I run out of time, I want you to tell the story of the border collie. I want a dog like this. Tell the story of this border collie who keeps the girl from doing, you know, smoking with the other kids at school.
This is a woman who sent this story in, and this collie, the border collie, is a smallish dog, and it, she said, raised her in a sense. It watched her. It was, you know, knowledgeable of everything she did, and that when she got picked on by bullies, this border collie would be there and protect her, and you know, had a sense of what was right and what was wrong. And I think that's one of the things that we learn from our pets. And this book does include companion animals as well. My own collie, when I was a kid, I always had the feeling it taught me some ethics. And I would watch what it did with the smaller dogs in the neighborhood. It would protect some of them. It did a lot of things that were extraordinary. I never laugh at the TV show Lassie because my dog did some of that. And when I was, I said to an animal behavioralist some years ago, that I thought that Banner, my collie, had taught me some ethics, and he dismissed it. He said that you're just anthropomorphizing, just romanticizing the dog. Maybe I'm romanticizing a dog. But as I was researching the book, I found some research about where dogs come from. All dogs are descended from gray wolves. Even the Pekingese is descended from gray wolves. And there's a couple theories about how those wolves were domesticated over a long time into dogs. One is that we domesticated them. We threw bones beyond the fire and they came closer. Another theory, and I think both of these theories are probably true, the other theory is they domesticated us. We watched them. We followed them as they hunted with the herd. We watched them and we saw cooperation. We saw teamwork. We watched wolf families, which are extraordinary families, and how they treated each other. We may have learned as much from them as they learned from us, our ancient ancestors. And so for me, perhaps that sense of ethics, and these research papers, these German scientists use the word ethics when they talk about this process, that the wolves had a sense of ethics. I think those ethics passed down to 30,000 years to a little boy in Raytown, Missouri, who had a dog named Banner. And I think that is true for many of us who have dogs. There's something that goes far back, that is far deeper than we usually think about when we think about our relationship with dogs.
Yeah, and this border collie that we were talking about, it basically, you know, nudges her away from kids who are smoking and, you know, makes her go home. And when it gets home, the dog jumps up on the table in front of the mother, barking at the mother. And the mother goes over to the girl and says, all right, you know, I forgot the dog's name, tells me that, you need to tell me what happened or something like that. It's like, what a smart dog.
Yeah.
And you know, I often wonder, I used to have a German Shepherd. And when I lived on this lake, you know, we had a little dock. So we had a little, you know, sunfish sailboat. We had a canoe and then we had a water ski boat and we'd walk down and the dog would always get into the right boat. And I never knew how he knew which boat we were going to. And there must have been something in our, you know, like what we were carrying or something that we were doing that he picked up on which boat. But that used to always fascinate me that he would always get onto the boat we were heading for. They're smarter than we give them credit for. Children often seem to have more insightful understanding to animals than adults. Why is that?
Well, we're open to everything that is new when we're very young. You know, you don't remember the things that strike us the most in our memory is the first time we had that experience or some of the first times. After a while, adults get a little bit jaded. Been there, done that. But to a child, everything is new. And so their heart is more open, probably, to these experiences with other animals because it's so new. That empathy they have is sometimes mistaken for, in a negative way, for anthropomorphism. But it's important to retain that. It's important for us to experience that again. I don't think our lives are fully there unless we have that sense of an extended family that goes beyond our own species. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is particularly true right now. Some of your callers mentioned this, what's happening now with the virus. It's important for us to look out the window, to walk outside. You don't have to go to the crowded park. You don't have to go to Yosemite. It's all around us, even the most densely populated urban neighborhood. I wrote a blog post, Last Child in the Woods, the first book that I did about this issue, which was about what I called nature deficit disorder. That led to a nonprofit called the Children and Nature Network, and that's at childrenandnature.org. And that's helping build this movement that's been out there for about 15 years. It's growing to connect kids and the rest of us to the natural world. And I wrote a blog that your listeners might be interested in about 10 things we can do to help our families get through the pandemic involving nature, 10 nature activities. And we don't even have to go out of the house. Right. Callers talked about watching birds from the window. I think one of the things we can do, kids certainly can do, is create a world-watching window where you just sit and watch. And it doesn't have to even be animals. It can be clouds. You can. Mm-hmm. There's a book called The Cloud Spotters Textbook where you can identify clouds. We have to get beyond our isolation. And this is true with or without the virus, but particularly true now. We need to go beyond our species loneliness.
Yeah. Ben writes, I had the opportunity to see the white deer in Woods Hole last summer. He was about 20 feet away. We met eyes and I looked deeply into each other. The rest of my day I was walking on clouds, something with so much difference and mysticism can make you feel very empowered and alive. Thanks, Ben, for that. And Carol writes, enjoying the nature discussion. Would love to hear about relationships with plants as well as animals. Lots of studies out there about trees having family relationships and the calm that comes to people in the woods. Good point. Thank you, Carol. And Becky is calling from Harwich. Hi, Becky.
Hi, good morning. And there's a lot of short stories I'd like to share, but I've picked this one out on one of my favorite walks around Harwich Conservation Land. Having gone at all different times of the day, I started going in the early evenings because I saw that there was always animal activity. And so one day when I arrived, I saw a fox come running out of the woods, and the fox had its back to me, and the wind was blowing from the fox towards me, so it didn't smell me. So I just started following it at a quick pace, but not running. And then after like about, 30 seconds, it stopped. It had sensed me, and it just completely stopped, and I stopped. And the fox watched me, and I watched the fox, and then it turned around and kept going, so I kept going. And then it stopped, and I stopped. Again, we watched each other, and then the fox kept going. So this walk that I do has a bench. So when I got to the bench, or when the fox got to the bench, it turned around and looked at me again, and it sat for a second, and then it kept going as the path continued around the bog, and I sat on the bench for a minute and watched just to see what it would do. And it was just trotting down the path. So I got up and started down the path. And And again, it stopped, turned around, looked at me, and then kept going. And then the same thing stopped. Then it sat, completely had turned around and sat and looked at me. And I stood there and watched the fox. And then I decided to just give that fox some peace and let it hunt and turned around and went back to the bench. But, you know, it was just the acknowledgement of each other's presence and the respect that I felt for us sharing this world and the open space, and that neither of us was intimidating the other. And it was just so beautiful that we both trusted each other and we were both curious.
Yeah. Becky, thanks for sharing that story. That's a wonderful story. We had a fox in Woods Hole a couple years ago, and it had its kits right on the porch next door to my grandson's preschool. And that was really fun. And the kids really enjoyed being able to watch those kits get bigger. But that fox was not afraid. It would walk around Woods Hole. I mean, just walking my grandson to school, it would walk right by us within 6 feet. It was really quite amazing. Becky, thanks for sharing that. Emily is calling from Edgartown. Hi, Emily. Do we not have Emily? Oh, okay. You know, we only have a few minutes left, Richard, and going back to the insight children have, you have a great story about the box turtle in the classroom, and their students are watching how it drinks water, but they really have some great insight watching this turtle.
The kind of the basic lesson of that story is that when adults walked into that classroom and looked at the turtle, they had a different reaction. They wondered if the turtle was, you know, they talked about, they felt that the turtle was of some use to them. The kids saw the turtle as for this turtle's sake. And there were, it was in the water at one point and bubbles were coming up, and one of the little girls in the class said, well, she knew what those bubbles were. They were bubbles of joy. The turtle is happy. Now, again, is that anthropomorphism or is that connecting to life around us? I make the case in this book that there are three habitats. There's the physical habitat, actually two habitats. There's a physical habitat. We spend a lot of time saving that, protecting the physical habitat for animals and plants. And then there's the habitat of the heart. And that's what exists between us and other life. We don't spend hardly any time protecting and preserving and talking about that habitat that exists between us and another animal.
Yeah.
I think we need to begin to do that. One of the things I hope for this book is, and I'm hearing from people they're doing this, is that when they read it, they begin to tell these stories to each other. I'd love family to sit around kitchen table.
We're gonna Richard, now, I'm afraid we're going to have to end
stories.
It there. Richard Louv's latest book is Our Wild Calling, How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs. We'll post a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. We could go on for another hour. Richard, thanks so much for being with us and for the work that you do.
Thank you. Thanks.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.